Good. Okay, good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you this evening to tonight's executive board meeting for September. Today's Tuesday, September 14th, 2021, and it's 8 p.m. here on the East Coast. And depending on where you are, the time's a little bit different, but that's okay. So listen, we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. We'll go ahead and call the roll. Myself, Mike Hoffpower, present. Vice President Randy Bauer.
Present.
Executive Vice President for Finance, Chuck Unruh.
Present.
Okay. Executive Secretary Fun Fong.
Present.
Members at large, David Hayter. Present. You're on mute, I think, David.
I'm here. I'm present.
Okay. Kevin Pryor.
Here.
David Day.
Present.
And John Fernandez.
Present.
Okay, so all board members are present. Are there any board members that have any new conflicts of interest that they care to bring forward at this time? Okay, we have a pretty full agenda for this evening. We have a few items that we will cover here in open session. Then we're going to address some other items in closed session. And there's at least one item that we will probably vote on in closed session. So we will then vote upon that again in open session for the record. So we'll start out today with a financial update for the months of June and July from Chuck.
What can I say? We just got the information in the last couple of days. I've been able to review it in detail. And Carol has kindly put together a presentation for us today because the new format is a little overwhelming at first. And it's good, and the news is good, but it takes a little bit of a dive into it to get that news out. So last year we talked about that we weren't hitting on all cylinders, that membership revenue wasn't keeping up. This year it's different. It looks like all sectors of our business are doing well. And at this point, Carol put this together, and I so appreciated the slideshow. So, Carol?
Oh, so I get to deliver it?
You get to do it.
So I just want to, thank everybody for their patience as we've gone through this transition. It's been a bit painful. There were things we didn't know until we got deeply into it. And just to recap what we've done, we've got a new chart of accounts, which are basically the general ledger codes where things get booked to in the accounting system. They look quite a bit different than what we were used to for the last decade or more. We're using a new accounting system. So the reports that we sent to you, Excel spreadsheets, were generated by QuickBooks Online, not our old accounting system, Sage. And we've also refined some of our accounting methods. And by that, I mean what appeared to be happening in the past, and it didn't dawn on me that there was maybe a reason for this. But throughout the year, as the board was looking at financials on a monthly or quarterly basis, we were largely using a cash accounting method for reporting our financials. And then when we were preparing for the audit at the end of the year, we were switching everything to an accrual method. So we were truing up the books at year's end. And so while the bottom line turns out to be the same, how you get there is very different during the year. And so since our new CFO team has advised that we switch to the accrual method for the entire year, which means a one-year membership is getting recognized 1/12 each month throughout the year. And so that's why you'll see some upside down unpleasant numbers on the bottom line, even though the cash that we're receiving for memberships is actually quite strong. And so these three things taken together are going to make our year-over-year comparisons challenging this first year. And the new format for our financial statements, the buckets don't quite line up. And so a year-to-year comparison on the financials is also going to be a challenge. So I tried to pull out some key numbers from the different financial statements and wanted to pull some things from the budget to actual, you know, those larger bucket items where we're sensitive to our expenses and our income because they're core to our business. And so if you look from the bottom up, our operating revenue is falling short of budget. And this is really driven by the timing of when membership revenue gets recognized. Events revenue was pretty much right on target. I mean, we're within a couple grand. And then restricted revenue, those are, you know, gifts that we might expect to get. We fell short there as well. On the expense side, our operating expenses are less than we budgeted for this time, which is the first 2 months of our fiscal year. And the same with the event expenses, they fell under. Now the US Open accounts are not all closed out yet. And we are still waiting for the bill from the hotel in Cherry Hill. To the point on membership revenue, I just want to point out that since the start of this fiscal year, we've generated $268,000 in non-life membership that's been deferred to some point in the future. Some of those are one-year memberships, some of those are two-year memberships. Those numbers can be picked up off the cash flow statement. And then we have another $20,000 in deferred life memberships that have come in this year thus far. Any questions about this and why some of the things are looking wonkier than they may have in the past?
I have a question about the events revenue. I would have, maybe if you can walk us through how that was calculated. I would have thought that based on the number of players we had at the US Open over and above what we were estimating, that we would have been far ahead on that.
Yeah. Probably was August, that's why.
Yeah, David, I believe the events revenue is just largely event fees. And I do not know if things like the invitational revenue that we received for support for some of the external events has hit this line item yet. It may still be in a holding account that was received last year. So I agree. I think our revenue might actually go up a little bit when we see the final numbers. Does that help?
Carol, is it possible on the accrual system that they would put money into August?
Yeah.
Possibly. Some of the money may have been received in August if someone registered on site. So,
okay.
It's entirely possible.
So even though the event is for August, if the money came in July, we still have it as cash.
Right. Correct.
Okay. The one thing that's not in this chart, and you may have it in another chart, I couldn't remember, but our payroll budget is doing real well. I think you were telling me we're running light one position that we had budgeted for.
That's,
so payroll is reasonable.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And so to Chuck's point, you know, I wanted to highlight some of the outliers in the budget, both on the good side and the bad side of the ledger. Membership, we're outperforming our budget expectation by $150,000. On tournament revenues, we're underperforming by not quite $12,000. And we're outperforming on investments. On the expense side, you know, our IT costs continue to be high, $34,000 over budget. Personnel, we're under budget by not quite $50,000. Magazine expenses, there's a small variance there. Part of that is, I believe, could be due to the Life member mailing that was done in July of the August issue. We did a special mailer to Life members who hadn't yet responded to our overtures to let us know that they were still interested in receiving services from us. Our legal fees, and I wasn't able to dig deep into this, and Deborah's away, but I suspect some legal fees from May of last fiscal year got booked into this fiscal year. And so they're running a little bit high. And then our events expenses, they really aren't an underperform. Those are, we spent less than we expected to, but that's a misleading number at this point because all of the expenses aren't accounted for yet.
I mean, how do we get to something that the layperson can understand here? Because we keep talking about, you know, well, this is not really what the picture is. So what really is the picture?
Well, Mike, for the U.S. Open, we don't have all the expenses in yet. And so we can't give a full report on the event. Plus, we haven't yet separated out the governance and the invitational expenses from the U.S. Open expenses. The way the system has been set up historically and currently, we are still lumping everything together, although Debbie has it on her to-do list to set up separate jobs for the events that should be accounted for separately.
I also think I don't think we have to explain monthlies to members. First of all, they don't get them. And there's a reason that, you know, most firms only do quarterly or semi-annually or even annually to even to shareholders, because there is so much just noise. So I'm not really worried about how do we explain some of this stuff on a month-to-month.
No, I appreciate that explanation, Randy. That makes perfect sense to me. Yeah.
So the other thing I was going to say is, you know, you take a subject area like legal, and we say underperformed. You know, from my perspective, legal is risk management, and we just have to spend what we have to spend on it. Obviously, we have to make sure that they're not spinning their wheels on stuff that doesn't matter. But I'm not going to look at the legal budget and say, oh my God, we can't ask for their corporate advice on something because we've already, you know, we're $7,000 over. You know, we've all over budget. So, you know, some of this stuff we just have to accept that it's going to, there's going to be variance.
And part of the reason this, you know, presentation was put together was to try to distill some of the things that are in the new financial statements. And rather than only presenting a long written narrative to be able to provide something graphical that's maybe a little bit easier to digest. And this may or may not be the right format, but I'm hoping that we can come up with a set of, slides that we regularly use to communicate what's going on within our financials.
Mm-hmm. Okay, not to belabor the point, I'm just wondering why we went to accrual versus the cash technique for accounting.
Well, if you look at our audited financials, They say that we use the accrual method of accounting, but what in reality throughout the year, that's not what we were doing, or maybe not doing consistently. And so our new CFO team advised us that, you know, we should be doing this. And we said, okay.
All right.
That's a topic.
Go ahead, Randy.
Go ahead, Randy.
That is a topic of what's more important, cash or accrual, for organizations all the time. And there are a lot of people. There was a point for U.S. Chess where cash was king, and we needed to know where we were on a cash basis because we just didn't have very much of it. And I think now, as the organization, you know, the cash is not really an issue with us on a month-to-month basis. We haven't talked about accessing our line of credit in years. So then I think going to accrual, which is a more robust way of accounting for various aspects of the organization's finances, I think that's probably right. Then, but we do also have to recognize that month to month, there's just going to be these things that it's going to look different when we're looking at the cash than when they put out statements on an accrual basis.
Yeah.
Thank you, Randy.
It's a matter of efficiency. When we're ready to do the audit, we're there.
That's
it's
true.
It's no longer scrambling for records.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Chuck. We hope, I think the first year will tell a lot, but we met recently with the audit team and the CFO team, and they're already preparing for next year's audit and getting the schedule set up so that when the year closes out, we're not, as Chuck said, scrambling to find things or update things that weren't updated all year long.
That'll be nice.
Yes.
Very much. The reason we're looking at some of the smaller numbers, the news is good, and it only gets better through August and into September. So I guess what could upset everything would be another spike in COVID that disables the nation.
Right. Which might be better for us.
Ooh,
sorry.
That's sharp.
I know. I didn't mean it. I said it with a smile, but if we don't have an Olympiad that we send all those people to and spend all that money, or World Youth, I mean, geez, it's
big. Saved us 270,000.
Right.
I agree. I don't say it's right. I mean, if we didn't do the mission and we just collected all the revenue, that would work.
But that's not what we're going to do.
No. That's not what we're doing, Randy.
But if it happens,
Okay.
So to kind of continue down the same road, I know that we like to track our membership revenue closely, and given the new method for the accrual method we're using, it makes it a little uneasy to see a net loss where we are in the year, and it really is a timing issue. We've received the cash, but we're not recognizing it on the books until we earn it, basically, which is for a one-year membership, 1/12 of the life of the membership. So I wanted to share the numbers year over year, last year to this year. And, we've received twice as much membership revenue, June and July, year to year. And when you consider that we've taken the magazine out of the basic membership and are selling that separately, when you look at that, the number is even stronger. We've met after the first quarter, we basically hit 50% of our target on the magazine sales for the year. So, I think it's all very positive. I hope the trends continue. We're gaining members back. And the membership sales piece, it continues to be building on what we were seeing at the very end of the last fiscal year.
I've been pleasantly surprised by the number of people who renew their memberships at tournaments and specifically state. They'll ask, does the magazine come with that? And when you say no, they say, I want the magazine too. What does it cost? And you tell them, $9.35. And they're like, no problem. Put it on the card. Charge it. It's no problem. So.
That's good to hear. Our balance sheet, our total assets continue to climb upward. That's what we're looking for, obviously. I'll point out that the second PPP loan, which we expect to apply for forgiveness probably around the 1st of January, it's still on the books as a liability. When that gets approved for forgiveness, that will come off the books as a liability and, you know, really impact in a good way our bottom line. I did want to draw your attention to the balance sheet line 22 and just point out that on the cash flow statement, you see the deferred memberships that have been received this year. Line 22 of the balance sheet shows the deferred membership revenue that is just sitting there from prior years in addition to what's being received this year. So that's $870,000, almost $871,000 that we will be drawing on and recognizing each month as the year goes forward. So we'll see our membership numbers as the year goes on, you know, the seesaw will tip the other way.
Where is this at, Carol?
Line 22 on the statement of financial position.
Total bank accounts.
I'm sorry. Let's see if I can. I will. I'll pull it up here. I'm looking for my. I have a lot of files open. Let's see. I think it's line 22. Oh, no, it's not. Sorry about that.
Well, and this is the balance sheet, and that would be on the income statement, wasn't it? And did we get an income statement?
We got a budget, budget to actual. So it's, be down there. Why am I saying line 22? I will have to get back to you on that. I'm not going to find it on the fly, David.
I found it on your positions, your statement of financial position.
Right. What?
Like the second page.
Line 77.
77.
Multi-year memberships.
Yeah. Thank you, Chuck.
You're welcome.
How did I get line 22?
Because I probably wrote it out and my sevens look like twos.
No. I don't think so. I think this was squarely my mistake. So, but thank you for finding the number.
That was an interesting try there. I mean, twos, sevens.
So let me. Anyway.
The question on that, and I don't know if Misty got back to you, is that on a 20-year basis or 30-year basis,
Yeah, they're now, and it's not clear to me which part of it is, so is it only new life memberships that are being, I guess, amortized over 30 years, or is it all life memberships? I imagine it's only the new ones, but I don't know, and she did not get back to me yet.
Okay.
This does say multi-year memberships, and then there's another $400,000 of life memberships that's deferred revenue showing up.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I think that was the last slide on that.
Okay.
Any other questions from board members?
Yeah. Carol, can you give us an estimate of the number of members we have now?
Yeah, I think it's 62,000, down from a low of 51 at the bottom of the pandemic. So we've climbed 10,000 in since May 1.
And every month we get that data is sent to us at the end of every month, just in case some people might have not known what it is that's coming to them. There's files that are sent related to members.
Right. And I'm just going to share just one other, so this is a daily tracking sheet that I set up and Debbie populates just so that we know where we are. We started doing this last year. So we can see by membership type, how many membership sales are each day of the year. It's not quite up to date since Debbie's on vacation for 2 weeks. So September is through last Thursday. And what I did a spot check this afternoon, and what we're seeing right now in September is a lot more youth memberships being sold. So I think that might be a promising sign for this upcoming school year. And membership sales can continue to be strong in the first half of September.
I anticipate they'll go up even higher, because right now many schools are withholding enrichment programs.
Carol, one question. Does it make any sense to do comparisons to 2019 just to get the pandemic out? And if so, have you done them?
So yeah, it does make sense, John. The problem we have now is this total overhaul of the accounting structure. So right now, without the member magazine sales, which is not an exact comparison, we're on track to probably generate 1.9 million in revenue from membership sales alone. When you throw in the magazine revenue, we're over 2 million. That's getting us pretty close to a quote unquote normal year. And we budgeted for 85% of normal. So I think, again, if the trend continues, we're off to a very solid start for the fiscal year.
Thank you, Carol.
Carol, I sent over something on the investment. Yes. I'll briefly talk to the investment arena. If you could share that with us.
Yep, I have it right here.
Okay, we have a record amount of liquid assets under management. You can see in the first column, we have $3,700,000 roughly of assets. It's being managed by various teams and committees. And our cash position, we think of our cash position as being overwhelming, that maybe this cost averaging has slowed us down a little, but when we go to the LMA and the reserve fund, we can see that we're 71.82% invested in the LMA, and that's after the transfer of the new cash. So we're close to fully invested there, and in the RF, we're almost fully invested within 11%. So we do have exposure to the markets. Now, the good news is that we're very conservative and our healthcare is holding up well, even in the market downturns. And our bond funds are holding up well because interest rates have not gone on to 2% as anticipated earlier this year. So the 26.22% in the endowment trust fund, so we're underinvested. We'll continue our cost averaging, but truly we're underinvested. We received another $250,000 just in the last couple of days. We weren't terribly underinvested until the generosity of our members and estates that are out there, sponsors, overwhelmed us. So we'll continue to invest in the market, 1/8 of the cash available every quarter.
Hey Chuck.
Yes, sir.
Could back to the twos and sevens. If you look at the reserve fund, I believe that cash should be 222 to make the numbers add up rather than 722.
Okay.
What he's saying is 1225 plus the 722 doesn't equal the 1417.
Here's why. Remember, we treat 40% of the U.S. dollars are an investment in the reserve fund.
Oh, okay.
So it's also treated as an investment.
Okay, I was trying to make the numbers balance there and was struggling.
Yeah, good catch that way, but that's why
I do actually pay attention. I know that's surprising, but you know.
No, I'm starting
you'll
to
learn
pay very well attention. So I'll make it more readable, but
thank you. I understand now. I thought that rainy day was something completely different. I did notice
part of the cash.
Got it. Thank you.
But what we've done is allocate rainy day funds as U.S. dollars. And I see as cash. Cash is what we have on board to invest.
Thank you for the explanation. Appreciate it.
Right.
Any other questions on the investments? We're on our investments. We're doing more than 7%. So it's been very good. Lots of capital gains. The market goes down. We'll give some of it back, of course, but we won't be giving the dividends back. They seem to hold up through rainy days. So,
Chuck also referenced a $250,000 gift that we received recently. That was a bequest that was left to U.S. Chest that we had been expecting for some time. And there may actually be some additional funds that come from that particular estate once everything settles out and with all the legal stuff that they still have going on. So,
was it directed at anything in particular?
Nope. It is completely unearmarked.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Recently, I requested emergency action on a couple motions where we purchased certain issues. Every one of those has worked. So we are batting 100% right now. So thank you for getting back to me so I could execute those.
If you're batting 100% in baseball, that's called batting 1,000, Chuck.
Okay, Randy, thank you. I like that.
And I just wanted you to know.
Chuck, do you mind maybe for people on the list, for the membership listening to this, do you maybe mind explaining at a high level for 30 seconds the difference between the reserve fund and the endowment fund?
Yes, I'd be happy to, David. Each one of these funds have a different goal. The reserve fund goal in relation to investing is to stay equal to or maintain value against the forces of inflation. So we're attempting in that fund to preserve capital is number one. Then number two, of course, if possible, keep up with inflation to maintain value in reserve fund. In the endowment fund, you'll find in the endowment fund a attitude toward longer term. Things such as the last 6 years have been poor for oil. We own some oil stocks. We think in 10 years, maybe it'll get better. So where the reserve fund may hold municipal bonds that are taxable, the endowment fund does not. It holds more long-term equities and funds that will produce superior results over time. All the funds target at least 5% dividends. Does that help? Or did I just confuse everyone?
that helps. I'm going to go with a real basic question. Why is it 500 grand? Is that the amount of money that would sustain U.S. Chess without any income for like two-thirds of a year, or is there a magic number that we have for that reserve fund?
Well, it's a good question. When we originally set up the reserve fund, remember I was talking to the point that capital preservation, rainy day. So those funds, it's the necessity of being emergency funds. We did what we call an IP, which is your investment plan or investment policy, and thought as a group that our investment policy should hold 40% cash. And that cash then was put into what we call a cash deposit ladder with multiple banks at 1 year. Unfortunately, the interest rate is so low that it doesn't matter anymore about going out one year. So that is why it was initially allocated that way, so that we could dip into the reserve fund in emergencies. And of course, we have used it once. That was September of 2020 for $150,000. And it came in very handy during that time.
So there is a kind of, there are some benchmarks that you can look at as it relates to reserve funds. So in a lot of respects, nonprofits and governments get lumped together. And one of the standards that's been used by organizations in that sector is 2 months of operations. And, you know, basically we're actually at 500,000. If you looked at that versus our operations, we would be above that standard.
Okay. We modeled the percentages after Dartmouth College. They had one that was similar.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of them out there. But I'm just saying that 500,000 in our current construct of our operational expenses seems like a reasonable place to be. I mean, ultimately, maybe at some point in time we want to change that to like a percentage of our operational expenses, because, you know, if we grow and become something different than we are right now. But I think it's a good...
That would be an excellent idea.
But for right now, I think it's fine. Mm-hmm.
We have replaced through earnings, even though we're 40% cash, 130,000 of the 150,000 that left in September. So it's done. The rest of the portfolio, the 60%, has made up for holding so much cash. So that's my update on investments. Everything's going well.
Okay, anything else, finance, Chuck or Carol? Okay, hearing nothing there, we'll move on to the next topic. Next topic is the scholastic regulations. The David Hayter and I have all seen copies of what the scholastic regulations are shaping up to be, but they're not yet ready. In particular, the formatting is a mess. So I've got to clean up the formatting on those things for them, because they didn't even know how to clean them up. And yeah, and then also they proposed a new appendix at the back about some rules for online scholastic tournaments. Really, it's for online national scholastic events. And I want to have a separate discussion with David Hayter for sure, to talk about that document, because there's some aspects of it that I've got some concerns about. So I'll send David Hayter and David Day the reformatted version, if not tomorrow, for sure by Friday. And then we can have a David Hayter and I can have a separate discussion about the this online appendix that they wrote. There's really no other major changes to the regulations other than some, they had initially talked about changing the names of all the events, but then they changed it back. But then the document that they sent us had it all the old way. So I've got to go through it and one by one, and it's not quite able to do a global replace because text is stricken through and not stricken through. So it's a manual process. So as soon as that's good to go, I'll get that to all the board members. So I anticipate, you know, after David Day, David Hayter and I are good to go, that we will get this, you know, done through the online process. Any questions from any board members at all?
Well, a comment from me. I think there was one other major change, Mike, which is the team pairings issue.
Yes.
That was spent a lot of time on. I attended the meeting where they hashed this out. And in my opinion, there's two very significant changes on team that we may want to talk about at some point. Now, of course, everybody agrees that teammates shouldn't play each other until absolutely necessary. But the devil's in the details. What does until absolutely necessary mean? They have tightened it down tremendously. The way they have defined it now in the draft is plus four, which is significantly different than plus two, which is what you find in the rule book. So what they're really saying is that if you're on the same team as your teammate, you don't play unless it's the last two rounds and you're basically on one of the top boards. That might be the right answer. I'm just saying they have really swung the pendulum. The other thing that they have done as a conscious decision, there was a statement in the last regs that if team and individual came into conflict with each other, which they sometimes will do, that the individual nature of the tournament determining an individual champion took priority over the team aspect. That has since, or that is in this draft, deleted. I'm not trying to say whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, but we need to understand that there is a strong preference, much stronger than in the past, of teammates not playing each other. And part of that is a residual of this past NOSC when there was some consternation about teammates playing each other. And Mike and Dave and I can talk about that offline, but I want the entire board to be aware of it. And if we want to have some discussion on that at some point in the future, that might be appropriate.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it gets into what's the primacy. What are we trying to crown? An individual champion or team champion?
Well, and what I'm pointing out is they're changing the primacy.
Right, and I'm kind of concerned about that. But anyway.
That's why I'm not trying to take a I'm intentionally trying not to take a position.
I know you are, and I appreciate that. I'm just pointing out that for me, I see that change, and I'm not sure I'm comfortable with it.
I have some angst, but I felt like I needed to get that on the table.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, especially when the rules state that these tournaments are first individual tournaments.
Right. You know.
Well, not anymore if we pass these regs. So
yeah,
there probably needs some discussion on that is all I'm
okay.
saying.
Okay, yeah, I agree.
Okay. All right. Thanks, David. Events update, Carol?
Yeah, so very briefly, Boyd was unable to join us this evening, but he submitted a written report. The board had asked that he begin to talk to the venues for the 2022 through 2024 US Open to see if we might be able to shrink the number of days of the US Open earlier than 2025. As Boyd points out in his report, there isn't a lot of enthusiasm for this. When you have signed contracts, they're golden. And so he's continuing to try to get their attention. But I think at the end of the day, the best we're going to be able to do is if the board so directs that we're going to move to a 7-day format for the US Open, it'll probably have to wait until 2025.
I mean, I was of the impression that we shouldn't spend a lot of time on this. Because it's a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And these people have contracts and they've been planning for that period to be taken in their facilities. And I just don't think we're going to get them to move on it.
And frankly, recovery is slow for the hospitality industry. You know, the staffing levels haven't returned to what they were pre-pandemic. You know, salespeople have turned over. So trying to redevelop relationships and you know, and ask for a favor when they have a signed contract. There's not a lot of incentive. And anyway, he's going to continue to take a run at it. But I think Randy, his sense and your sense are aligned, and that is it probably isn't going to yield a lot of positive results for US chess, and we're not sure how far we're going to
I don't think it's a productive use of time. I just think that he has enough stuff on his plate that shouldn't be a big priority.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, that I was in the minority on that opinion, but I still believe it's still my opinion. So
it's worth a try, but this is not the market where that's going to happen. So,
well, it seems to me that maybe we say that now the try has occurred, and now, you know, because it seems like there was at least an initial effort, and it was met, you know, with lukewarm acceptance at best. And I'm now, you know, I kind of agree with Randy that at some point you got enough to do. Let's move on
with what we're doing.
Yeah.
I thought that was always the intent. It does seem like he's probably done what we've asked him to do.
Yeah.
To make the inquiry and that. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's you know, a Sisyphean task, I think, at this point. So, and then very quickly, the K-12 grade nationals, the registration opened right around the U.S. Open, I think during the U.S. Open, and registrations are starting to trickle in, even though we've done little or no promotion of the event. We're going to start, you know, with the promotion now. We don't expect Florida to shut down. So any consideration we might have gotten from, you know, a state government on, you know, with restrictions on having big events, we don't expect to happen. So unless something catastrophic or the pandemic somehow becomes worse than we've had in recent days, I think the K-12 grades will be happening as planned, and that is the that we're acting that way. Staff is hired or almost fully hired, and the board will be meeting in Orlando. So that's that. Of course, we continue to monitor all of the key metrics, but the trend on locking down, as we were talking about as the meeting was getting underway, there doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite for that, even in more progressive states. So I think we'll see you in Orlando.
Okay. So Carol, I think we're ready to go to closed session.
Okay.
Okay, well, good evening again, everyone. The executive board had a good discussion in closed session. Now we're coming back to open session to summarize some of the topics we talked about. One of the topics that we had talked about was a U.S. chess privacy policy that we have in place, or the new privacy policy. So let's go ahead and state the motion for the privacy policy.
Okay, I have here the executive board moves to approve the privacy policy and website terms of use policy as drafted. We would like to further note that there are different policies for U.S.-based residents versus those living elsewhere. The practical result of this is manifested by U.S. residents being able to opt out of mailings, while GDPR nations having to opt in for mailings.
Okay, all those in favor of the motion, raise your hands by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, passes 8-0.
8-0.
Okay, the second motion, we had a discussion in closed session about U.S. Open 2025 and beyond, and the delegates, some of those of you who are listening are delegates. Remember that this was a topic of discussion during the delegates meeting as we look forward to a new structure to the U.S. Open, and it was discussed in the U.S. Open committee workshop, you know, at the U.S. Open. So fund go ahead and state the motion that's been put forward?
Yes, the motion has been put forward by Mike Hoffpower. The executive board moves that starting in 2025, the U.S. Open shall transition from a 9-day to a 7-day schedule, with day one being Monday and day seven being Sunday. Invitational events will be held on Monday through Wednesday, days 1 through 3. Selected committee workshops will be held on-site on Thursday and Friday, days 4 and 5, with most workshops occurring online 1 to 3 weeks before the U.S. Open begins. Online workshops cannot be scheduled before publication of the delegate's call. Side events will be scheduled at the discretion of the director of events.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion, raise your hands by stating aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Hearing none, that passes 8-0. Fun, is there anything that we're missing out of closed session?
No, I don't think there's anything that we're, let's see, we talked about the state and affiliates call, that the intention to have a town hall with the state affiliates. And
yeah, that's a good thing. That's a good point. So I'll go ahead and state publicly for the record that we're going to try to schedule a call between the executive board, those members who are able to attend, and the state chapter presidents, those who are able to attend. If the state chapter presidents want to bring in their board to that meeting, it's fine. But we're going to try to schedule that sometime in the next 30 to 60 days and just to have a meeting with all the state chapters to hear what's on the minds of those in the state chapter. Thank you, Fun, for reminding me of that.
Surely.
Randy, anything you'd like to say?
Nope, I'm good, other than don't call me Shirley.
Okay, Randy.
We're missing. Okay, I'd like to thank the board members for an engaging discussion this evening. It's been a long board meeting, one of our longest, I think. but this gets stuff done. It's the business of the Federation, and I appreciate everyone's attention to the detail and the hard work. So everyone have a good evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.